Today's Teisho will be on case 26 in the Heikigan Roku, in the Blue Rock collection. Hyakujo sits on the Great Sublime Peak. Case 26. Hyakujo sits on the Great Sublime Peak. Main subject. A monk asked Hyakujo, "What is the most wonderful thing?" Jo said, "I sit alone on this great sublime peak." The monk made a bow. Jo struck him. Secho's verse. Across the founder's field went galloping the heavenly horse, Basso's successor. Different, however, in way of teaching, in holding fast and letting go. His actions were quick as lightning, always fitting. The monk came to tweak the tiger's whiskers, but his effort made him a laughing stock. Well, you have to admit, you know, Zen is a little different, right? A little different than most things. It's definitely not, most people's world, that's for sure. Main subject, a monk asked Hyakujo is Baijiang, great master Baijiang. And Baijiang is the name of a sublime peak. There's a place called Mount Baijiang. It's a mountain. 100 fathoms is how it's translated. So a monk asked Baijiang, "What is the most wonderful thing?" And Yang said, "I sit alone on this great sublime peak." The monk made a bow, and Joe struck him. You know, if you look at anybody who's not familiar with Zen, if they heard this story, they'd say, "Huh? No." But none of that makes any sense. And one of the most puzzling parts is the monk bows and then, you know, it's hit, you know, the end. This is a really beautiful koan. And really, I think one of my favorite koans in the whole Blue Rock collection, in the whole Blue Cliff record, if you want to call it that. Today is day three for most people here, and it's a day when, in many cases, it becomes possible to experience the world a little differently, a little differently. You know, it may not happen yet, but if not, just hang on. When we come to Sesshin, usually we come with all of this stuff trailing off our bodies, hearts, and minds, you know. All of these, like tendrils, or vines, or, just stuff, you know. All of these concerns and fears and worries and dreams they intertwine themselves with our shoelaces and our shirt and our buttons, and we can hardly move after a while. We're dragging all this stuff with us. I always liked the image in the Christmas Carol. You know, Ebenezer Scrooge is going through like a nervous breakdown, and one night he sees the in a dream state, he sees his dead partner, Morley, and his partner is dragging all these chains, his body. He's got all these chains wrapped around his body, and attached to the chains are all these cash boxes, because that was his life, was making money. And so his ghost is bound in all these chains, and he's carrying all these cash boxes. And he comes to warn Ebenezer Scrooge, you know, this is the fate that awaits you. If you really, he doesn't put it this way, but he said, if you don't liberate yourself from your karma. You know, basically, Scrooge has to go through a process of transformation in order to break those chains, right? And this is kind of what sesshin is. You know, we come with all these things trailing off of us, and they're making us ill and unhappy and confused, and finally we don't even, you know, one of the most amazing things in the world is that you can ask somebody, what do you really want, and often they just have no idea. You know, they just are so pulled in this direction and that, you know. Fascinating. So, you know, most humans are trailing all of these karmic burdens with them or through their whole lives, haunted by events that have happened in the past. And not necessarily through any fault of their own, you know, they aren't able to liberate themselves from these burdens. Or another way to put it is they didn't necessarily do something wrong. Sometimes injustice was done to them, or something bad happened to them, and it just left this chain, you know. And so people are dragging more and more of this stuff, and maybe at some point they think, well, maybe I'll try Zen, and they come to sesshin at some point, and so first couple of days, it's hard to cut through all of this, right? It's hard to begin to liberate ourselves. But sitting in the moment is really a very powerful, is a very powerful medicine, you know? It's really amazing, right? I mean, we're sitting here, of course, in a special yogic posture. These postures, these asanas that come from India, were actually derived like from a major research project that went on over several centuries, just like Ayurveda, which was like a medical research project, or Tai Chi in China, which is another kind of research project. In India, people were interested in the relationship between body and mind. And they experimented with different postures and different states of mind. And it was discovered, actually, that different states of mind arise from different body postures. And eventually, people came to the conclusion that the posture of the seated meditation was the posture most appropriate for enlightenment or the pursuit of awakening. So this is a part of, we sit on the cushion with this posture, which is, you know, sort of strange to Westerners, but it's a therapeutic, you could say, therapeutic regimen, right? It's very Western to think that you can clear up your mind without working on your body. Basically body and mind are one unity, so part of getting healthy, you know, sesshin you could think of as like karmic hospital, right? So you're coming here to liberate yourself, to get rid of your chains. This is like a detox program, you know, mental detox, or body, heart, mind detox. It involves sitting on the cushion in this weird way, which is experimentally derived from ancient India. And quite ancient, by the way. They found some little clay tablets that are more than 3,000 years old. And they have pictures of people in lotus posture. And there's a very famous ancient image of a person sitting in like a lotus posture, and he has on a helmet, like a Viking helmet with the horns coming off the side. I don't know what the hat means, but the inscription is supposed to say Lord of the Animals. See? So this goes back a long, long way, you know, and there was a religious significance to these postures, but then later they understood it rationally as a therapeutic regimen. And, you know, if you're not really ready for meditation, sometimes I recommend to people that they should try yoga for a few years until they can get into this asana, one of the two asanas we use here, either the seiza or position with your legs folded under you, or the one version of the lotus or the Burmese posture. So this is like therapeutic regimen involving the body, and then when the body's in the appropriate therapeutic regimen, we can work on the mind, and all we have to do is come back to the moment over and over again. And we could do various things, you know. We could we could meditate on an object like a image, or we could meditate on a mental image, or we could meditate on a candle, you know. Everybody could have his little candle, and we could all be looking at the candle, and that's not bad. That's not bad. And in many meditation traditions, people work with an image, like in Tibetan Buddhism. But actually, we work with the breath. So the way we come back to the moment is by fixing our attention on the breath. And this is like very good, because the breath, if we focused on a candle, or we focused on a picture, we're not harmonizing body and mind as fully as we could. So when we focus on the breath, see, we're harmonizing consciousness with the body. So this is like perfect, you know, I think. It creates a body-mind unity. So the body's in a balanced, energized position, this lotus-type posture or the seiza posture. And then we're focusing the mind on the breath, and so synchronizing like the whole system, right? And the breath keeps bringing us back to the moment, even as our mind neurotically wanders away. You know, and so, you know, it's just coming back to the moment, coming back to the moment, coming back to the moment. And we have many investments in not being in the moment. You know, some of us, I remember years ago, my father, in a spasm of guilt, decided he wanted to be closer to his sons. And his intentions were good, you know. He decided that we were going to join the Boy Scouts, and he was going to become one of the Scoutmasters. You have to understand, my father's a military man, so this is how he thought. So we were going to join like the Army, and he was going to be a commanding officer. And by the way, I loved my father, you know. So this, you have to understand the spirit of this. You know, it's just my dad, you know. So he became the Scoutmaster, and we had to join the Boy Scouts. It was an invitation you couldn't refuse, you know. So one of our projects was to go on a 50-mile hike. My father grew up in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and my grandfather was a mechanic, you know, fixed cars. Before the war, my father used to drive a beer truck for the Pabst Brewing Company, and then he was able to, he was in the Navy, and after that he actually got to college. He was the first person in my family ever to go to college. Anyway, he became a career service person, you know, a military person. My father was kind of a chubby guy, let me just say. My mother used to hurt his feelings sometimes, because she used to say, "You look just like Jackie Gleason." Most of you don't know who Jackie Gleason is, but it would be a little bit like saying, "You look like John Candy," You know, my dad was like, you would say probably overweight. Yeah. So we went on this hike, this 50-mile hike, and my father, it was just, my father had never been on a 5-mile hike, right? And we were supposed to do 10 miles a day with heavy backpacks. His friend was a man named Mr. Sayre, also military type. They had used the old, like, army-issue military packs, and, we carried things like cans of food, you know. It was just crazy. The packs must have weighed 70 pounds, you know. So anyway, it was a nightmare in a lot of ways. But I have to say, I've become a lifelong hiker. And I got to spend some time with my dad. And it was really the first time I got to spend time with my dad. What happened was that I ate a bunch of blueberries and had some kind of an allergic reaction about halfway through the hike. And my face blew up like a balloon. And my skin, you know, developed all this, like, this big rash. So, like, under my chin, it was all swollen. It was just like some kind of major allergic reaction, you know. Nowadays, they'd have whisked me out of there and taken me to the hospital, but they had a more casual attitude then, you know. Saying, well, I wasn't dead, you know, so I'll probably be okay, you know. But I was sick, you know. I had, like, a fever, you know, and I couldn't go on. So my dad, this was a great opportunity for him to bail, because Mr. Sayre was in very good shape. He used to ride his bicycle to the base headquarters every day. And my father just was, you know, he was just in agony. He was really, he shouldn't have been allowed to go on this hike. Really, he could have had a heart attack or something. And he said, well, I'll stay with Kurt. And so we stayed at one of these shelters along the Appalachian Trail, which is, we were hiking on the Appalachian Trail. And I was in a bunk, and my father was there. And I observed my father, and I saw a person who had so much difficulty being in the moment. I mean, it was incredible. I remember just watching my father, and, you know, he was a, you know, he'd light a cigarette and smoke the cigarette, and then when that was gone, he would be like nervously looking around, and so he started doing little projects, you know. So he gathered firewood until we had like this huge firewood pile, and then he cut it all up, and then he sat there, and it was like, now what do I do, you know? And he was so nervous. I even as a little boy, or maybe later, I realized my dad was just like, he had a tremendously hard time just being in the moment. And maybe he had like ADD or something like that, some kind of a problem like that. But it was torture for him to be in a quiet, it was, you know, we were in this beautiful, quiet place, and it was just torture for him to just have nothing to do and to be in the moment. And he, you know, he went through all his smokes, and that made things even worse, right? And basically, he found a deck of cards. I think he had brought a deck of cards, of all things, on a hike, on a 50-mile hike. Just maybe because his pack wasn't heavy enough. So let me have a deck of cards, too, along with the cans. Really, that really happened, I swear. You know, those guys, it was amazing. You know, so anyway, you know, I remember him playing, trying to get me to play when I was too sick, and playing solitaire, and smoking his cigarettes, and sighing. My father had a very hard time being in the moment, you know. And he's just a human being. I mean, I learned so much. I love my father so much. He, like all people, he made a lot of mistakes. And he was such a, like, a haunted person. My father had some rough upbringing, and he had a lot of, he was trailing a lot of chains, you know, himself, and couldn't figure out how to get free. I think he would have really benefited from like going to a psychiatrist. I really do. I think my dad had, you know, a personality disorders. And that's very widespread. I mean, I'm not criticizing. It's not criticism. I love my father. He would have really benefited from some help, I think, as so many, as everybody would. We all would. And he was just incapable of being in the moment. Maybe when he was in the moment, you know, he was kind of haunted by things in his life. Maybe he didn't want to think, you know, about things. So he was like a very busy person all the time, but I think it was just a kind of like a constantly needed to stay busy to distract himself. I mean, I don't have all the mysteries of my father solved, but anyway, it was very illuminating to see somebody who had such a hard time being in the moment. And I don't think he could have done Zazen, but maybe he would have benefited from a psychiatrist or some help. But, you know, fortunately, everybody here can benefit from Zazen. And not everybody can. That, you know, that people come to our sit and they're unable to get into the moment long enough to, you know, to begin to feel the therapeutic effects. And that's a tragedy, you know. culture needs to work out other mechanisms that will help people who are, too, like my dad, too haunted by their ghosts. Maybe their consciousness is, in my opinion, too deformed to be healthy, you know. And psychiatry is really one of those mechanisms that our society has worked out. But if people are able, if they're mentally healthy enough to, in a way, deal with the fact they're not that healthy, right? Average human being is not that healthy. You know, you come and do Zazen. And, you know, when you sit on a cushion, you begin to notice that you're a screaming lunatic, really, you know? Yes? Don't you think that's fair? I mean, basically, everybody's like, you know, I mean, we have a kind of image of human beings, which is sort of like the rosy image we'd like to have, you know. But then every once in a while, somebody drops a nuclear weapon, right? Or somebody goes on a shooting spree and kills 30 people. And what we want to say is, well, we're not like those people. But I think that those tendencies are present in everybody. And everybody's sort of like running scared a lot of the time. Maybe my own upbringing has given me a distorted image of things, but my feeling is that people are mostly injured by life in a lot of ways, and they have these deeply rooted habits which often make them unhappy, violent, fearful, envious, you know, and so on. And when we come to Sesshin, you know, all of these little tics and things, you know, are there, and we just keep coming back to the moment. And the amazing thing, in my opinion, is that, you know, being in the moment is so therapeutic. That you know, you sit in the moment, and you know, there you eventually come to terms with, you know, your impatience, your anger, your fear, your you know, I mean, people respond differently. You know, everybody's unique, and people respond differently. But if you stay in the moment, by about day three, you drop some of those chains, you know, and the pure simplicity of being, you know, without any conditions, is such a wonderful state. You know, it's such a wonderful, wonderful state. And we don't, oddly, even though it's wonderful, it's so hard for us to get there a lot of the time. I think that's just realistic, you know. I mean, even if we haven't suffered really like violence in our lives or terrible tragedies, life is scary enough. You know, I think life is rather scary a lot of the time. You know, I had a pretty easy life. But, you know, when I would go to school, my father was stationed in Baltimore, Maryland at one time. And I just remember, you know, if you could get to school and get back without getting beaten up, it was like a good day, you know. And I can just remember as a little kid being really scared of physical violence, you know. And you know, that's bound to matter, you know, to how we are. So, there's something really wonderful about the pure simplicity of being in the moment. It's hard to achieve, and not only because of things that have made us afraid or things that have caused us pain, but you know, there's a whole socialization process that goes on as you're growing up. You know, another important person in my life, besides my father, was my PhD director, a guy named Gary. I won't give you his last name, I guess. His name was Gary. And I met him when I was going to graduate school, and he seemed to be one of the most brilliant and sophisticated people I had ever met. I originally was interested in like Renaissance literature, you know, like Shakespeare and stuff like that. And I went to graduate school because I wanted to do Zen, to tell you the truth. It gave me a job where I could make $8,000 a year and have time for sashimi, right? And when I had been, I used to move furniture, and people say, what are you doing? I said, I move furniture. You know, they'd say, oh, okay. But if I said, I'm a graduate student, they'd go, oh, graduate student. And what are you studying? Shakespeare. Oh, come in, you know, please, how impressive, you know. So it was a strategy. But when I got to graduate school, even though I wasn't deeply committed to it, I wanted to do well. I wasn't committed to it like personally or existentially, but I didn't want to fail. And I began to take it very seriously because I began to meet people I admired, and then who I wanted to be like, and then whom I wanted to like me, right? This is a very human relationship. So I met people and I thought, oh, now he's very admirable. You know, this guy Gary is very sophisticated. He was really like a very, he knew, very learned and old, sort of like old-worldly sophisticate, you know. And he always dressed, you know, in a suit. He would come to work in a suit. You know, when he lectured, he would recall verses. He'd say, as Shakespeare says, blah, 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 blah. You know? Like, wow! You know, that is so cool. You know, he's so cool, you know. His wife, Molly, was beautiful, you know. And he'd invite me to his house. And it was, you know, he was just like a fund of this learning. And, you know, he'd fine wines and, you know, he'd go to England every year. It was just like, oh my God, he's so sophisticated, you know. And, you know, you see that and you think, I want to be like that guy, you know. And then you want so desperately to be admired by that person. And then I would see other graduate students go through the same process, you know. Where they would become sort of like psychologically addicted to their mentors. You know what I mean? So I remember running into a friend of mine who was a graduate student, and she was almost in tears. And I said, what's wrong? And she said, I saw, you know, Charlie Altieri today. I said hello, and he didn't even say hello to me, you know. And this was like a psychological disaster for her, right? And you might think, well, what's that all about? But that's how society works, right? It binds you into its reality. You know, you start out thinking, well, I'll go to graduate school. I don't really buy it, but you know, it keeps me off the streets. You know, and then the next thing you know, it becomes very important to be liked by all the right people, and so on and so on. And you begin to worry at night if somebody didn't say hello to you in the hallway, the right person, you know. And I remember at one point, my very sophisticated dissertation director, Gary, He changed universities. He left the University of Washington and he went to Cornell. And when he was at Cornell, I was working on my dissertation trying to finish, and it was very hard to get him to pay attention to me. I'd send him my chapters, but he took a long time to get them back to me, and it was hard to communicate. I couldn't just go in and talk to him and say, "What do you think I should do with this chapter, Gary?" You know. He was so remote, and I began to fall behind. And I thought, "Gee, I've got to finish. You know, I've got to wrap this up." So anyway, I went to another professor in the department. His name was Eric. And I said, "Look, I'd like to change my committee. I'd like you to be the chairman of the committee, and Gary will be on the committee, but I need some guidance. I need somebody here who can help me." I got this blistering letter from Gary. It was just like blistering. And basically what he said was, "I know why you picked Eric. You picked Eric because his reputation is better than mine. You little rat." You know, it was like that. You know. I was astounded, you know, because first of all, I didn't know that. But the other thing was, that wasn't my motive. You know, all I wanted was to get my dissertation done. You know, I was just this, I'd been going to graduate school for 7 years, and I wanted to wrap it up. And the letter was so nasty, and it was clear this is somebody whose feelings were so hurt, and who was so deeply insecure. I thought he was the most admirable, sophisticated. I thought, you know, if anybody has all the answers, it's Gary. And in that letter, I saw exposed all of these human failings, you know, which everybody has. But you see somebody who's so deeply insecure, maybe deep self-loathing, and so on, you know. This is another way, there are these chains we bear in our lives from injuries done to us, and from experiences like getting beaten up on the way to school and so on. And some of them are quite terrible, you know. My mother, my mother's father came back from World War I. His jaw had been blown off. And in those days, they didn't have plastic, you know. So they made him a metal jaw. Not kidding, you know. And reconstructed his jaw with pieces of metal in the. And this was apparently, like, incredibly painful. You know, it was just apparently he was in agony. When my mother was like 7 years old, she came in the kitchen and he had blown his brains out all over the kitchen floor. And to the day my mother died, that kind of thing really stayed with her. I think it had a huge effect on her, as you can expect. And so there's those kinds of events, you know, which my mother didn't pick, you know. And then there's these other subtle forms of, like, you could say, socialization or even indoctrination, where people, you know, you get drawn into these collective realities, and then, you know, the collective nightmare becomes your nightmare, right? I mean, we think the people we admire and respect are totally with it, and that society is totally with it. But then, all of a sudden, you know, society does things that are totally crazy and irrational, like going to war, right? Or other kinds, you suddenly see, you know, people grow up thinking, well, my parents, they know, they're good people, they know what reality is, and you want to please your parents, and then one day you realize that, you know, your parents are racist, or they're dishonest, you may be lucky enough to see the limitations of your society, but every once in a while, like, societies just go off a cliff, you know, and you think, how did that happen? How did 50 million people go so wrong, you know? But that's a collective reality. You can't, I don't think you can trust it either, because it's interwoven with all of these neurotic fears. So, you know, what we're even though Zen is a kind of a socialization in itself, it's true. And of course, I admire people like Genki Roshi and so on. I still think that this practice is a little different, because what we're trying to do is to really strip away all of these chains, you know. You know, when you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching your breath and your back is straight and so on, and you're in the moment, you know, this really deeply therapeutic. I believe that it gives you a kind of personal freedom that's really, I don't think anything else in our society is like that, you know. It's really a kind of amazing freedom. In that condition, you know, if you stay in that condition long enough, you begin to see that, you know, my name is Kurt. You know, I pick up a check every 2 weeks at University of at Rutgers, and it has Kurt Spellmeyer on it, and I take the check, you know, let anybody else take it. You know, it's mine. And, you know, I have a house, you know, and the papers are in my name. But when I'm in the moment, if I stay there long enough, I realize that I am not Kurt Spellmeyer. I am not. That is a mask or a game that I play because society asked me to, right? That is not my true nature. And yet, you know, I like all people, I have a lot of Kurt Spellmeyer problems. You know, I didn't come to the cushion already awake, and I've been sitting for 30 years cleaning up my karma. And I must say, it's definitely worth it, in my opinion. But what makes it worth it are those wonderful moments where all of the chains fall away, and for it might just be a moment, might be an hour, you know, might be a couple hours, and eventually longer periods of time, where you're free. You're really free. You're not Kurt. You know, you're not 55 years old, you weren't born in Philadelphia, and so on and so on. You don't have to be a good person. You don't have to be a bad person. You're not a sister. You're not a brother. These are all just roles we play. And in this condition, you can reconstruct your life. You know, it's possible, a lot of our actions, not always, but a lot of our actions are motivated by fear. You know, we're so afraid of not being loved, we're so afraid of being rejected or not respected, that we do all kinds of stuff we really don't want to do necessarily, but we're afraid not to do it, you know. Nobody wants to be no one, going nowhere. This is terrifying, right? And yet, you know, if you stay in the moment long enough, you realize it's actually quite a wonderful thing to just be this nameless consciousness resting in the moment. You know, it's really quite wonderful. And, you know, you can rebuild your life and not be driven by your fears and your attachments. When you're in the moment, a lot of Zen practice is just learning how to trust the moment, learning how to trust all. And we just don't trust. You know, the great way is one with the trusting mind, Saint Sam says. You know, the trusting mind. You think, what's that about? It's everything. The trusting mind is so important. We learn, if we stay in the moment, we learn to be one with the trusting mind. You know. And then we can rebuild our lives in a different way, not driven by fear and our attachments. And the interesting thing is, you know, people are not only very afraid, in my opinion, they're very, very guilty, you know, ashamed. I think these are incredibly powerful. People are afraid, they're guilty and ashamed, and they're angry. These seem to be quite widespread conditions. And not everybody, it doesn't cover everybody, but it seems to be quite widespread. And my feeling is, you know, people are, maybe they're angry because they're so deeply ashamed. You know, and, you know, if you're in the moment and you learn how to trust the moment, you know, one of the things you find is, you know, you have a lot of compassion suddenly, you know. And one of the things that eventually happens in Zen practice is that people get the ability, you know, the last person most people ever really love is who? You know, it's you, right? I mean, it's me. You know, the last person the last person anyone can love is the person himself or the person herself. You know, it's so, you know, we think our culture is very narcissistic, right? People run all over the world trying to make themselves happy, right? But that's not the same thing as loving yourself, which is very close to forgiving yourself, you know? I'm not a genius, you know? I'm not. You know, it's okay. It's okay, you know? Some people, I know people who literally are like consumed by self-loathing because they've written 9 books but they're still not a genius, you know? And it's they're going to write 9 more before they die, and you know, maybe somebody will pick this up and go, my God, they are a genius, you know? But, you know, even if you're a genius, you know, history books are full of forgotten geniuses, you know? So, you know, most people just can't get right with themselves, you know? It's not get right with God, it's get right with you. You know, you can't get right with you. I can't forgive myself. I can't forgive myself for not being X, Y, or Z, you know? I just can't do it. You know, this is like, this is the biggest chain of all. And even though it's a cliche, and even though Whitney Houston has already said this. You know, and indeed, Whitney Houston is consumed by self-loathing. I mean, drug addiction, unbelievable. Her life is a hell realm, right? So saying it and singing it on the radio doesn't make it so, right? I mean, she has chains we can only imagine. But the truth is, you know, the capacity to love yourself is actually quite crucial if you're going to be a compassionate person in the world. Now, the Western view is always, love others and eventually you'll be worthy of love. See, that's the Western model. But I actually think that's deeply flawed because it's still a neurotic relationship, in my opinion. I mean, there's another way to live, which is that, you know, if you stay in the moment long enough, you just forgive yourself. And if you can forgive yourself, you can forgive anyone. You know, it's the most, you know, honestly, I think that's true. If you can forgive yourself, everybody's already off the hook, right? It's true. And so the hardest thing is loving ourselves. Hardest thing is forgiving ourselves. And you can't do it. You can't snap your fingers and say, okay, you know, I'll love myself. You know, it's not that easy. That's like the triangle, right? It's like the triangle. You know, it's not gonna. Hearing a teisho doesn't make a difference. You know, it doesn't. If it were that easy, you know. But if you just keep staying in the moment, eventually it becomes possible to really have a different relationship to your, not only to the world and to others, but to yourself, which is the most crucial thing. So when somebody says Baijiang, a monk says to Baijiang, what's the most sublime thing? See, he could say Buddha. He could say, some lofty. He says, here I am on this sublime, I sit alone on this sublime peak. Now, you know, a conventional view would be how narcissistic, how selfish, right? But I think that in a certain way, this is a healthy relationship to the world, right? You say, I'm not emotionally dependent on anybody's approval. You know, I, the whole world is love, you know. I don't have to be loved, you know. I am loved, you know. And I think this is paradise, you know. And I don't think it's narcissism at all. I think narcissism is when you're desperately trying to please others all your life, and you're doing this, you're doing that, trying to be worthy of that love. There's nothing that can make you worthy of that love. There's nothing. In my opinion, there's no deed you can do that will make you lovable. Really, I just don't think it'll work. And I can stand corrected, but my feeling is, if you just stay in the moment, sooner or later, it becomes possible to forgive yourself and to love yourself, and then as I said, everybody else is off the hook. This is like a karmic hospital. Learning how to trust the world, learning how to trust life, learning how to have compassion for everything, including this, even oneself. And that's pretty amazing. Main subject. A monk asked Yakujo, "What is the most wonderful thing?" Joe said, "I sit here alone on this great sublime peak, here in this moment. I'm here in this moment. Nobody else can be here in this moment but me. Here I am. Everything you encounter on the cushion is your experience. Nobody else can tell you what it means. Nobody else can have it for you. When you encounter your true nature, you know what you have to do. You know what you have to feel. You know what you have to be." So a lot of Zen practices... Oops, going on too long. I stopped. The monk made a vow, and Joe struck him. The monk's still trying to get approval. See? Monk still wants to be approved. He says, you're a wise one. Okay, let me bow. And Joe says, you don't love yourself yet. Okay, Secho's verse. Across the patriarch's field went galloping the heavenly horse, Matsu's successor. Matsu is the heaven. This should be galloping the successor of the heavenly horse, Matsu. Matsu is a horse ancestor, is what his name means. Okay, so Baijen was a great Dharma descendant of Matsu. And his actions were quick as lightning, always fitting. The monk came to tweak the tiger's whiskers, but his efforts made him a laughingstock. So really, Secho is really warning us here, don't get hooked on Baijiang either. See, koan, when somebody really wants to pay him a compliment, they say Baijiang was an idiot, right? In Zen, say he was a blockhead and he didn't know anything, meaning he was deeply enlightened, right? So in this case, what the koan is saying is, hey, Baijiang was a great Zen master. You should worship him, right? So what they're really saying is, don't fall into the trap of worshiping great Zen masters. Be in the moment, and that's the path to enlightenment, right? Just be in the moment.